David Barsamian of Alternative Radio, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Cable Community Radio's annual meeting and board election will be held on Saturday, September 20th at 11:30 a.m. at Mississippi Studios in North Portland. At the annual meeting, members will have the opportunity to meet candidates running in the board election. Final votes will be cast and counted. The results of the elections will be announced at the end of the meeting. Online boarding is open now through the annual meeting at kabo.fm/board25. Paper ballots will be sent to members by mail. Again, that's KBOO's annual meeting and board election on Saturday, September 20th at 11:30 a.m. at Mississippi Studios, located at 3939 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kabo.fm/board25.
KBOO's Loud and Proud. Become a member during our KBOO's Out Loud Fall Membership Drive, taking place now through September 20th. Your contribution goes towards grassroots, independent, radically made, community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give. and help us reach our $45,000 goal. Thank you.
Plugged In on KBOO is a radio show dedicated to underground electronic music. The show is hosted by DJ Tronic and features deep house, tech house, techno, drum and bass, breakbeats, future bass, downtempo, and more. Plugged In frequently has local producers and DJs on the show, and we provide info about upcoming events in Portland, including free ticket giveaways. Plugged In airs the first and third Friday of every month from 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. Pacific time.
One, two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
DVD Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Want to tap in with somebody who definitely should know what exactly is happening in the city of Washington, D.C., the nation's capital. Nefta Freeman is no joke. He's part of Black Alliance for Peace. He's an activist. He's a radio host. D.C. is in his blood. He went to school there. He's on our sister station, WPFW, longtime advocate, and is it okay to say freedom fighter for all the work that you do? Because you stay busy, man. Yeah. You have, you know, I could go on for like days just talking about you, Nefta.
Yeah, don't do that. And now I'm going to have to, a lot of people do this. You do it, it's the net sound, net, and then for, and people don't even realize they're doing it.
Oh, wow. You know, what did I say?
Netfa. You said Nefta. Everybody does.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, okay. And you know what's interesting? And I just like, is little kids ages 9 and under don't do it. But once they start, people start getting that age and they start doing it, I don't know what it is. I find it.
Well, you know, the kids are a lot smarter. You know, they see all the letters, they're just learning to pronounce it.
Exactly.
I just see the Nef and then I see the Ta. And it's, then, you know,
yeah, it's NET. Net,
yeah,
and then pho.
But you know what you need to do, brothers. You need to move the F in front of the T and change your name.
Yeah.
And then we can all be on point. You see what I'm saying? So get yourself an American name, and we can be okay.
I used to get that all. I used to get stuff like that all the time. Not, if not American, whatever, all kind of stuff. Ethnic is too. I had got a job. They said, no, your name is too ethnic. I'm like, what? What name doesn't have an ethnic origin? I don't even know what are you talking about?
And when it's important enough, we will find a way to pronounce it, am I right or wrong? So
right, that's true. It just takes a little practice from people, that's all.
No, I got it now. Net Fa. There we go. I wanna dial into what's happening in DC. Mm-hmm. And here's a few things. one, it was very hard to get a lot of folks on that were on the ground. I saw a lot of videos, and every time we hit up people who were making the videos, it was kind of like, well, maybe we could do, you know, there was a lot of hesitation. Then I talked to people, and they were like, well, you know, we're not black. You should get some of the black folks to do it, because the narrative was, it's only white people doing it. And then lastly, it came down to some folks were saying, it's not as bad as it is. It's more blown up than what they're showing. And so it was hard to get a read, and, you know, finally, you know, got back on vacation, said, let me hit you up and find out what the real is, because, as I said at the start, this is your home, and you're on the air, and you know exactly what's popping. So what is happening in D.C. right now that they're not showing on the news that we need to know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I try to stay tuned. Plus, being, you know, an organizer, you got to be up in it. Well, the federal government has, you know, imposed itself and certain things on Washington, D.C. in terms of federal agents and, you know, put troops in the street and all that to accompany the Metropolitan Police Department. And also, what's lost in a lot of this narrative is that the response of the D.C. government, at least in the mayor's office, is capitulation and collaboration. Yeah. Because we're hearing a lot of, you know, talk is being framed as the D.C. takeover. And I say for us, I'm talking about most Pan-African Community Action, PACA, which is, you know, we're a D.C.-based organization is trying to work for community-based power, you know, particularly African-led community-based power. And we don't say D.C. takeover because it doesn't make, you know, much sense. They're basically just intensifying and fortifying what has already been taking place under the mayor in terms of, you know, putting out this crime, this narrative around crime, which is really just a ploy for containment and control, which is really, it's just an occupation, you know, intensification of the occupation, colonial occupation. And when we say colonial occupation, we want to be clear because the D.C., there are elements of the D.C. that will use that language, but really just, talking about the statutory disempowerment of Washington, D.C. in terms of its representation in the Senate and the Congress and whatnot. But we're talking about the underlying, overall system that doesn't even just apply to D.C. It's the settler colonial project, you know, that goes all the way back, and that we are still living under the disempowerment of that condition. We are internal colony, and then Washington, D.C., the localized expression of that, and the intent of the powers that be, whether it be on the federal or local level, to sustain that project, that oppression, that repression. And so what we're seeing now is our, you know, arrest, a criminalization of homelessness, you know, of youth, and particularly black youth, a criminalization of people who are migrants to the United States and may, you know, not have their pass, their pass law, you know, stuff. And it's just sweeping criminalization, because we could see when Donald Trump started talking, the supposed targeting was supposed to be people who have committed crimes. That's who they've been claiming is, you know, they're going after in terms of immigrants that they're going to deport.
Right.
But the data shows that his immigration crackdown has included thousands of people in the D.C. who have no criminal record at all. I mean, this is about like over half of the people who've been rounded up and in detentions and pending criminal, deportation. And this is ICE data, you know, ICE data that was collected by the Deportation Data Project. And so this is what's happening. We say the criminalization of youth and black youth because it includes it all. And that, again, we want to emphasize that this stuff has intensified it's an intensification under the Trump administration, by the federal government and the Trump administration. But we say intensification because these things, this trend was proceeding. before, right, with the crime bills by the DC City Council and the mayor put in drug so-called drug free zones, you know, trying to contain where young people in our own communities could move around, fare evasions,
the broken window theory type, right, of thing. Let me ask you this. Mayor Brouther, she definitely is interesting in how she's being amplified and framed. So we often hear the narrative, especially after this last election, listen to black women. So she plays that card. I'm a black woman from DC. Listen to me. And we need these police, and this is great, and the surge is great, and all that. And then you do a little bit more digging and go, oh, wait a second, she's like handpicked by Michael Bloomberg. Mm-hmm. And I bring this up because many people may not remember Bloomberg, when he was mayor in New York, openly stated on several occasions that the police there was his private army. Remember, go back and look at that. So you already had a guy that was in this mindset of what we see taking place. This is my private army. They're going to, you know, execute the tasks that we're going to do. And then in many ways, the dovetails or aligns with what we see playing out, like go in, contain, get rid of these folks who, you know, can be othered for a variety of reasons. They're too young, they're immigrants, or whatever criteria they put. But she was already in the neighborhood, so it didn't take much convincing. And I guess the only thing is, when they talk about decolonizing our minds, we got to decolonize and look beyond. Yeah, you're a black woman. Yes, you sound like my sister up the street, but my sister up the street is not co-signing, you know, what's That's happening right. in D.C. Listen to that black woman, not this one. You know what I'm saying? But yeah. And I say this, and then you could comment, because they have people that are now being resurrected in Chicago. You know, I'm on the feed and I'm seeing, like, look, I live in the South Side and I'm telling you, we need this. And then, you know, they play that card. And unless you're comfortable enough to say, shut your mouth and sit down and have several seats, right, you're going to back off and say, well, she's from the South Side, she must know what she's talking about. And so I want to get your comment on that, because there is confusion about who she is, and the way she's coming across is making it sound like, well, maybe we should have it over here in Oakland. Maybe we need it in Detroit. Listen to what the sister's saying. Listen to black women. Not that black woman. I don't listen to Candace Owens either.
That's right. I mean, what you said is very important, and I think it speaks to the omission of the class aspect of things and class mm-hmm. interests, and what we refer to as the comprador class, you know, those who pose and profess to be working in our interests, usually the comprador class. That term has been used applying to other countries, you know, like in Africa, and the puppet governments and puppet, you know, class that serves the interests, purportedly trying to serve the interests of the people, but really ostensibly serving the interests of a foreign dominating power. And that's what these people do, like Bowser and whatnot. And it's, and she's not alone, but what you outlined is very important for us to understand what they do. They serve as cover, political cover for the policies of repression, of austerity, of everything that they do. And that what's also happening is what can be referred to as an identity reductionism, and the playing on the fact that our people and those who've been oppressed can be sometimes or often fooled by the fact that the people's immediately presiding over the system and doing the bidding of the powers that be and the ruling class and the capitalist system and the white supremacy and all that look like us. You know, they can put it, you know, they can put a black woman in, a black man, a black person in, black woman in, a black LGBTQ woman in, or whatever. And then we arrest all other kind of faculties, and we're told that this reflects progress, you know, and that they're doing everything. And it's not until people are really dealing with the material conditions on the ground that they face, you know, that we really understand things. What you also pointed out was also very important is that we don't, you know, when we have our ear to the ground and we in the community, and we're not fooled by these exceptional people that they come and take, you know, like you said, you use the Chicago incident. They're doing the same thing here in DC, where they'll find the pockets of people who say, well, you know, we need this here. You know, we're the troops coming in here because we got crime, you know, calling for this thing. And that we know that there are also people who don't want it. In fact, they're the majority of people, and they understand what how repressive this is. And then we have to, you know, we have to be careful about how the media frames things and how they kind of package stuff and not think this is a popular situation. And that we had to understand that also that they're also exploiting the fact that the symptoms of this system of capitalism and whatnot do create contradictions within our communities, intercommunal violence and small petty crime. And I say petty crime because the big criminals, you know, like will wipe out your whole country. Those are criminals, you know, wage theft, right, on a, you know, level of corporations and whatnot. That's the kind of crime that doesn't get into the media. And so these kind of things are real. And so when we talk about when we expose the contradictions of the system, we also got to know our people are vulnerable to being misled, because if we're not addressing real things, you know, the root causes of them, though, because the system ain't trying to address no root causes. We know, you know, I mean, everybody should know, and they should know that the root causes of things like crime and violence and, you know, stealing and all that kind of stuff is poverty. You know, you solve poverty, yeah, then you solve those situations, and you actually can have programs that mitigate that and bring up people's self, you know, self, their understanding of the systems, their self-worth, their understanding of their own history, who they are and whatnot, and dignity, and distribute things. People don't want to, you know, be living in dangerous, violent, you know, circumstances. It's what we're born into, and that the system is not doing anything about. But to your point is that, like, Mayor Bowser and these other, you know, compradors around the country, and we've seen this for a long time across the United States, particularly on local and state levels with mayors and governors and even city councils, and particularly in the major urban, you know, centers in the country, you know, New York and L.A. and, you know, wherever, D.C., where the Democratic Party becomes leading this, where you get, you know, black folks and even black women now who are doing it, and it kind of serves as a buffer in a confusion about the root causes, and even reflects in some people's mind that there's some progress. Now with DC, Bowser, you know, the stuff that people are upset about in DC, the deportations, you know, DC was a sanctuary city. And it's still, right, supposedly be a sanctuary city, where the deportations, they weren't supposed to cooperating with ICE. Before the Trump administration even came into office, there were moves to try to repeal the law that was going to, and it's, wow, like the early 2019, they declared sanctuary city. And you can even see here, you got quotes from Bowser, you know, commending it and supposedly proud of them being a sanctuary city. But ever since then, you know, under the cover, you know, when nobody's paying attention or trying not to pay attention, she's trying to repeal it. And then also things like, you know, the crime narrative, you know, why we don't really, and people really think about it, the what we are seeing on the ground are not so much federal agents. We're actually seeing more MPD, you know, than anything else. They're what you call it, when you compliment it, or when there's fortified or whatever, you know, added to them, their ranks, right, with federal agents. But for the most part, they're still MPD, and they're carrying out, and they declare cooperation. The mayor's declaring cooperation, and you probably heard the statement where she was commending what the, yeah, Trump administration did after talking about it, like, you know, always suspect and whatnot. And she even makes it clear they have helped fortify or complement or increase what we were already doing. That's what she said, you know. And so this is the kind of thing that we have to look at, that there's a systemic issue here, and that those people, those of us who fit under a certain, you know, homelessness or young people who may need jobs and direction and education and whatnot, are an expendable class or a problem that they don't know what to do with. And also those of us who are actively trying to fight the system and expose it and create, build alternatives to it, we also a problem. So some of this criminalization for them and some of this criminalization is trying to be set up to lock us all up or do something to us, you know.
Netflix Freeman is our guest this afternoon at Washington, D.C. Let's talk about the root causes of crime and put a dollar analysis to it. So we hear that $170 billion, not million, but billion dollars is going towards ICE, right? If I'm correct in my numbers. Okay. Yes. So even if it's $10 billion, but $170, right? With the work that you do, and even just focusing on D.C., how much money would it cost to really counsel, provide resources, make sure there's no more homeless people in the street, that they have housing, but more importantly, to look at a group of people who you say, these are people that seem to have a troubled way of doing things. And, you know, maybe it's people like you and a few others who are able to go counsel, walk them through life, life coaches and all that. How much do you think that would cost to do over a 4 or 5 year period to really turn things around? Would it be $1 billion? Because that's even a lot. Or we're talking about something that might be a few mil.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think we can, people, the reason why most things cost so much is because of waste and red tape and bureaucracy, and that also the disinvolvement of the people who are most impacted by it, you know, because the people. So, and I'm a revolutionary, I'm a socialist, you know, and I believe that the solutions of the, it's not just I believe, it's a proven fact that the solutions around, you know, education, around housing, around medical care, can be radically transformed if the people impacted by them are provided even minimal resources and can come together and think of that part out. And as organizers, we could facilitate the process. You know, we can.
But let's walk through that for a minute, though. $170 billion.
That's a lot,
right? And you're in D.C. What would it cost? Like, if I could write a check right now, and you say, man, you know, what, you know, roughly, what do you think it would be? And I'm not being facetious, but I'm just kind of giving people an idea to think, because many people have done tremendous work, including, you know, you all, with very little, if anything. And I'm saying, here's $10 million over the next 2 years. What can you do? You know, the school system, here's $20 million. Because $20 million is a drop in the bucket when you're talking about $170 billion, right? Mm-hmm. So we're talking about there are resources. But right, if you have all these billions, what do you intend to do with it is the question. Because it doesn't seem like they're going to improve the schools. It doesn't seem like they're going to have life counselors and things like that to talk to people who you feel are troubled. You know, what's that money going to go towards?
It's going toward criminalizing the young people. It's going toward the resource officers, cops in schools. It's going toward, you know, facilitate, like having, you know, what you call it, the fortifying the fair, the gates on the metro so that people can't squeeze by them and whatnot. Having more cops, you know. Now, I mean, to answer your question, I might need a budgeted out answer, mathematician, you know, right, accounting type answer to expand it. But I mean, we could do very much. A lot has been done with very little in the past. We've even seen that. We have a program right now that we're launching. We don't even have, you know, we have very little Pan-African Community Action. That we have our People's Pan-African Wellness Front. And we just going trying to start. It's inspired by like the Panthers. And we know the Black Panthers Party did a lot. They had free breakfast programs and people's clinics and, you know, all right. kind of things too. And this is what we're trying to, we're inspired by that model. And we know that that was undermined and targeted by the system in the state because it was successful, because it was something that they, that was a threat to, you know, this exploitative right. system. And also inspired and modeled by, so this is our health care. We're just going to start small with diabetes testing and high blood, hypertension, high blood pressure testing, things that are, and like chronic diseases that are curable, that are preventable, easily preventable. And that don't take much. And you involve, not that we couldn't, I'm not saying we don't need the resources, because you want to expand it out to scale so it has much impact. And it's also inspired by the Cuban healthcare system, that door-to-door and doctors who are dedicated to, you know, dealing with people's health conditions versus making money off of being a doctor, right? And you can take Cuba as an example, a system under serious, you know, one of the most intense forms of blockade and economic sanctions and all kind of other subversion around the world, but they still provide all their citizens with free healthcare, with free education, all the way up to the university level, all that. We could, you know, now the difference, the only difference in what we're dealing with in DC and what other organizations are dealing with, and they try to do the same thing in their communities, is that we don't have the support of the state. The state, you know, is used as a tool of the ruling class here that puts profit before people. You know, and so we're trying to put people first, and we want to also, it's not, we know that like the revolutionaries before us, and even like Cuba, both the Panthers and Republic of New Africa and all those who did those things, tried to do those things, it wasn't just about providing charity and social service to people. It was about involving the people themselves, helping them become agents of the solutions that they're trying to face. And this is what we got to do. When you do that, the amount of financial resources and whatnot is mitigated. You kind of pull together real material resources. Where can we get, you know, aspirin? Where can we get this and that, you know, just in case? But then, you know, this is when things are put, when people are put before an environment, put before profit, we find that we can do a whole lot. And the problem is that there's those who are ruling that it's against their interest to allow that. And so, and then we find these exorbitant amounts, like you said, 170 billion. I mean, just think about the military budget, you know, yeah. It's like 800 billion. This is all to sustain the profit before people paradigm, as opposed to the opposite. It's creating death, destruction, and repression, as opposed to building up, you know, humanity and creating integrity and collectivization and all of that kind of stuff. So, you know, I just think that that's where we have to, people have to be able to see that there's a better way. Not only that there's a better way, and that we have to be able to do it, but that this way that the what's dominating society now, particularly in the U.S., but it's international, is an existential threat.
Right. Netpa Freeman is our guest. Let me ask you this. Another narrative that's been pushed may not come from folks who are in alignment with the mayor, but there's another type of line being pushed that it almost romanticizes oppression. I've heard people say, you know, our eyes will be open, brother, once we, you know, we need Trump in office. We need this sort of thing, because this oppression is going to force us to open our eyes. And once our eyes are open, then we're going to all come together and we're going to make things happen. I've heard that, you know, I've heard people say that. I've hearing people say that now. It's going to unite us. And once we're united, then maybe we can separate and then we can have our own, right? So you have people that say this. And one, is that working? Is that happening in a place like DC right now? Or is everybody sitting there coming together? My experience with that, unless you have a certain politic like one that you expressed, where you're quite aware and you are mentally prepared for hard times, Others who don't have that political education become desperate. And then they look around and they're like, well, Mr. Freeman got a car, let's take his car. Mr. Freeman got food, let's take his food, because we're not, you know, we haven't been conditioned for that. But you tell me, because here it is in real time. You got all these troops, you got people talking about, let's go for it. And as you said, you already had a city council and a mayor that was moving in that direction already. Mm-hmm. So now the hammer's come down. And is it paradise? Are we all together? Are we in the streets saying, brother, let's go on to a better day? Or what's happening?
Wow, this is a good question. Really, really good. And I can tell, I can describe what's happening, because it is, it's definitely not as simple as those who would have us believe that, oh, you know, intensify things and you'll see something happening. We have to have been doing something all the time. Organizers got to organize, no matter which, you know, which faction of the ruling class is in power, the Democrats or Republicans, or whether some you know, what you call the except the interesting phenomenon of a Donald Trump, you know, is added to the Republican ethos. And that when we organize it, we got to be clear politically. We have to have some revolutionary consciousness that only comes from collective political education. Political education in the ground. Now there's a lot of mobilizations in DC. We had our own, we did our own PACA and PACA and Black Alliance for Peace DC, and some other organizations that we mobilized our own thing, because we wanted to do something that definitely tapped into this, gave much more of a radical and revolutionary analysis to it and flavor, and had people understand this is not just we can't reduce it to Trump. We can't reduce it, and we can't call it a takeover when it's just and so we did that. And then you have a lot of other mobilizations, and some of them are calling for solutions. They're some of them are reducing it to Trump, you know, and they mean well. I ain't trying to disparage nobody, I guess. And then some of them are also reducing it to the question of DC statehood. I don't know how familiar you are the fact that Washington DC, and the listeners might know, is not officially a state, right? And one of the narratives for a long time for Washington DC is that things will be different. And so if it had statehood and was not subject to the you know, whatever the whim of the Congress or the Senate, that can repeal things and whatnot. But this is something that we feel misses the mark, you know, and is not deeper analysis, because the fundamental issues that we face, and then so you have a lot of mobilizations pushing this, and we'll go to the mobilization, we support it, but we can't push a line that is not get to the root cause of the issue. The city of Baltimore. The city of LA, the city of New York and Philadelphia, wherever you want to, Jackson, Mississippi, they all belong to wider jurisdictions that are states with statehood. And they got the same fundamental problems we got. And so, you know, people don't have housing. It's, you know, targeting of, you know, non-white people by the law enforcement and deportations and health care and all that stuff. So this is not the fundamental contradiction, and it can be a red herring, you know, if that dominates the discourse and we're not really playing. When we say there's a systemic issue, we got to name the system, you know.
Right.
And so part of what you're raising is that, and my answer, I'm gonna try to answer more explicitly what you're raising, is that no, there can be conditions that emerge that can make it more conducive to organizing and to radical transformation, but that in itself, it doesn't do it alone. And then you got to be careful with it. It has to be, we have to be prepared for it. We have to be fighting. We have to be and using things to show the people the fundamental contradictions. We have to be calling them out, because there's the enemy is sophisticated. They find ways to actually even co-opt what seems to be movement stuff. You know, the term called rad lib. I don't know if you heard that term before. And so rad lib, you know, where it's really basically a liberal reformist political disposition, trying to reform the system instead of change and transform it, but using radical, you know, language, radical, you know.
Well, that's training. Your mayor right there.
Right.
That's the mayor right there.
And the mayor's doing it, but there's also even more radical stuff that she won't even go to. There's still not. There still ends up being reformists and what, like the nonprofits and all that kind of stuff, you know, friend, and people who are actually mobilizing and will call out the mayor when she does it. And they also, I mean, maybe I'm getting a little bit, but we got to be careful that they're also not, we're not pushing the fundamental issues in the fundamental analysis, the contradictions. And so, no, in and of itself, these conditions will not just intensify conditions like a Trump or whatever will not just make everybody come together. We got to be involved in protracted revolutionary organizing and be able to be prepared to, you know, take advantage or call out the contradictions or use them to expose the system as it comes. That's what really will do it. And regardless of who's in power, we have to be able to show that, I mean, in terms of who's in power, in terms of the which faction or, you know, right, persuasion of the ruling class, it's not going to solve our problems.
Let me ask you this. What are some of the victories that you've seen on the ground right now? We talked about some of the things that are glaringly problematic, but I've also seen videos with people pushing the National Guard out the community. I've seen mm-hmm. brothers, you know, that are on the block clown them, you know, and you know, there's this notion that we're afraid, and a lot of times we're not, you know, like I might be afraid, but the dude down the street ain't afraid. Right. You know what I'm saying? You know, he's built for this, and you know, and I've seen that sort of bravado and intelligence and you know, cats letting folks have it. Yeah. And calling out the contradictions, and they may not have the words, right, the correct verbiage, but you know, their heart, not only is their heart there, but their analysis of power dynamics is there. Even though they might not use those words, they know that somebody's trying to step on them and they're not having it, you know, plain and simple. And they know that they're outgunned, but they have other ways in which to deal that. So I've seen that as very encouraging, you know, mm-hmm. and I don't see those videos being amplified in, you know, in real time. First of all, it doesn't fit the narrative. It's easy to show white folks and say, you know, have a mayor go, yeah, it's just white liberals that are out here fighting against the National Guard. But in our hood, we want them, right? That's the other narrative that they push to kind of divide and conquer. But then I'm seeing these brothers, you know, that's like, we don't want you here. And they're in Southeast, you know, and Anacostia and all those places. Then it's like, well, you're not showing that. You're not pointing out, you're not bringing, you know, Ray Ray up to the stand mm-hmm. and going, how does he feel? So how are you seeing this in terms of victories and even just building off that type of on the ground resistance that I think needs to be highlighted more?
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you raised that, brother, because we seeing those videos too. And we know that they, you know, that's the, not just the videos, but even we do door knock, we go into the community and we talking to people, you know, right. And we know what people are thinking, you know, and when, you know, when you ask them, they'll tell you, you know. So it's those videos, like the when you see in real time people resisting the police and calling out police, and even having been able to turn back a detention, like an arrest or a deportation and stop it. This is happening, you know, driving, you know, ICE at least temporarily off of a block, you know, and preventing them from snatching somebody up. That's just, that stuff is happening. And so that to me is very encouraging. And I think sometimes we see these videos and I was just texting this to my comrades the other day, because one of the Instagram videos, and I said sometimes we'll see these videos and we'll get indignant, you know, our emotions will take over because we're watching the cops, we don't like what they're doing. But I'm watching what you just said, the reaction of our people and how they're driving. It's like, it's the old understanding, age old understanding, oppression breeds resistance. You know, the enemy can't understand that. You know, they think that they can just subdue us and you know, into submission. That's not what happens. It's natural. So what we have to begin to do when we see this, the only issue left is this. And then there's a kind of, I would say, maybe a bit of a, you know, bougie class aspect of it, because some of our people don't want to go into the community. They want to be in the, you know, moving spaces and don't want to go, you know, not just doing actions, but going and reaching our people and discussing and organizing our people. The issue with this resistance is it is not organized. That's the only thing, you know. Yeah. But that's where we get people with heart. That's where we get people that have nothing to lose, you know, and will call it out. And so, you know, that's where, you know, I find that is very inspiring. And in fact, it's even tied to the question you raised before, previous question we raised before, but like I said, it's just, it didn't just start with Trump or whatnot. But I'm seeing more, you know, that we're seeing more of that, where people are standing up to these and instinctively saying, nah, you don't need to be here and whatnot. We have to reach that element in our communities, and we have to, you know, talk to them and find out, you know, one, we're learning from them too, because we're not arrogant to think we go in and we politically educating our people. We educating each other together, and we figuring out how can we address this in a more intentional and organized way.
Right. And I think what you said, Netfa, is really important, because if you don't organize them, if I'm the enemy, and I think one of the goals is to, under the pretense of fighting crime today and getting rid of undocumented folks yesterday and maybe getting the unhoused, right? These are three trigger words that can have a group of people go, yeah, I'm for it. But if the end goal is to get rid of movement folks, if I'm the enemy, I would go to those cats on the block and go, here's 50,000. You know, you can actually continue to do what you need to do. But when you see those guys from the Black Alliance for Peace, or you see those Free DC folks, or you see whatever movement people that are out there, shut them down for us, do the dirty work. Mm-hmm. And that would be a continuation of what I see going on now. People are asking, how come the Democrats aren't fighting back? I'm fighting harder than the Democrats. And I'm saying, you know, this is just my assessment. The Hakeem Jeffries of the world looked and said, we don't have the stomach to do the dirty work. Can you all do it? And you got Republican guys like, yeah, we go do it. We get these weapons, we get this money, and we'll go bash on these folks, and then they'll employ people in the community, you know, a little gangster up in the community, say, mm-hmm. you can have your turf. Just make sure that these people here that is doing all this protest, and you go shut it down for us. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, if you're not really engaged with your community that way, that can happen. And we already saw bits and pieces of that when you get some folks that's like, well, you know, this president's the one that freed me with the Second Chance Act. No Democrat right. did yeah. that. Yeah. And I remember going to Detroit, and we was in some neighborhood, and they was like, you know, Trump came to our neighborhood. City council person never came here, but him and RFK came and sat there with us for 2 hours, no cameras, and talked to us. And it's like, are you serious? It's like, mm-hmm. man, they came here, so... you have that aspect. Like, if I really want to get the community bashed on, let me just empower the criminal element and redirect their energy, you know, towards mm-hmm. you.
Right, man. That's another good important point, because you know that's that covert ops type stuff. You know.
Yeah.
And that we have to remember as organizers, like you said, that's what we got to be. Going, you know, reaching that sector of the community. And we have an advantage that they don't have when we do it, is that we can make legitimate appeals to their self-interest and their humanity. We can connect a humanity to their self-interest. We can also, with the advantages in the what I would even call maybe even counterintuitive measures that the system takes with the deportations and all that, with effort, we can get people to see the commonality, the common interest, the common enemy, and whatnot. But you know, when, because everyone's not motivated by self-interest, and if you're yeah. skilled in talking to people, you can pull out the humanity in them and show them, you know, this is right. what we need to do. Also, one thing, because this is what part of that tactic, when you say when they might give people money or something like that, is that there's a material interest that people
have. Well, that's a thing of desperation. That's what I meant with the desperate mm-hmm. times. Right. Not to cut you off, but you can build on this. But the desperation could be, Netfa, you really need this money. You know, your organization's starving, blah, blah, blah. Man, I'd give you $1 million every year. Your budget's taken care of. But I do need you to wear this cape for the administration and their action. That's one way. Or the other way, which I think often happens, and this again is an old ploy, you was at the Diddy Freak Off. Now, we don't, you know, your comrades don't want to see that. I mean, we can keep these pictures to ourselves, but I'm going to need you to carry this water, you know? And so those are the types of things, you know, again, around the, you know, the understanding of desperation. I can't afford to be, you know, found out that I crossed these lines. And I think, you know, unless you have relationships with people where they're like, man, I can't sell out my mother like that. I can't go down that road. Or the relationship is such that you can actually come and say, I was at the freak off and, you know, y'all going to have to forgive me for that. You know, we go, we understand. Mm-hmm. And ain't no hard, no, ain't no foul on this, right?
Right.
But if we, if we're totally disconnected, then folks will, they'll take the money and run.
They'll take the money and run. And actually those, that tactic, and this is why I say we have an advantage, the people that they can appeal to, that the people they're going to be looking, they're, those are minorities, you know, for the most. And so we, if we build a community relationship, then that minority can be isolated, and what the damage they can do is going to be less, right? And then again, you know, people, there's some humanity in people. If we can know what to say, and we can appeal to, well, this is a self-interest you're doing, you know, we got, we can actually, and we have to have a, and this is where I was going to go, we also have to have some material, something material to offer. Mm-hmm. And if we can do it with the community, and we don't have a lot of resources, but we can muster what we can do, and we appeal to the fundamental basic needs of the people. That's why the People's Wellness, Pan-African Wellness Front is one of those things we're trying to do. And we can show people, we can mitigate the struggles, the material conditions we all have as a community if we come together and think about this stuff, you know, organize and address them. And that you create a situation for anyone who's approached to sell it out, got to make a decision. I mean, this is like you said, you selling out your mama now, you know, because you, you know,
right.
And that if we also politically educate people about, you know, what is real, you know, the, do the, what we call the dialectics of criminality and all this kind of stuff, then we create a different society. What you did at the freak off, we can forgive that. That ain't nothing. If you sell us out, nah, ain't no forgiving that.
Well,
you know,
that's still a universal rule.
Mm-hmm.
No snitching and all
exactly. And they know, and then you lift it up. This is why. And where did the no snitching came to me is also part of, as an instinctive understanding about the system in opposition to the masses. You know, you helping aid and abetting the system to keep us down. That's what you're doing. You know, that's where that comes from. You know, so we got to figure out how to, you know, understand this is why we have to have a relationship with the people, organized with the community en masse. And also we got to find how to base that relationship, have a material, a component that provides, helps provide for the people, or at least puts people in a position to provide for themselves. And when you create that, you kind of isolate the elements that will sell out. They're not going to go nowhere, but they're going to always be those elements.
Right.
But, you know, they have to be. That's how you isolate them.
Netpa Freeman, our guest this afternoon, as we close out, how can people get a hold of you? Any last words you want to share with us from D.C.? Anything you want us to do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we got to amplify this. This is a colonial occupation disguised as public safety and defining crime and whatnot. That's what's happening. And it's spreading across the country. It's really reflective of the imperialist, you know, not just across the country, across the world, really. I mean, we're a pocket of the global South within the bounds of the settler colonial state. I think that's important for us to understand. And we got people around the world that are down with us in the global South. And that the way to get in contact, Pan-African Community Action, PACA, the easiest way is to follow us on the social media, PACADMV. On social media, on all the social media platforms. And we are a member organization of the Black Alliance for Peace, which you can follow, you know, there's different social media for Black Alliance for Peace, but the website for Black Alliance for Peace is blackallianceforpeace.org. And what we're doing on the ground now is part of the broader campaign of the Black Alliance for Peace to defeat the war against African people in the U.S. and abroad. And so, yeah.
Well, there you have it. Netpa? With a T,
Yeah.
Freeman, my brother, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon, giving us a lot to chew on. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. Thank we'll be you, right back.
Hard Knock Radio. We're rocking with Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
My last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah.
I thank you, members and supporters of the Palestine Youth Movement and others gathering in Dearborn, thinking about what's happening in Gaza, in the West Bank, and beyond. Before we begin, I ask you a very simple question. When have you ever seen the level of destruction that we are seeing every day in Gaza? I would guess that no one in this audience can describe a similar level of mass slaughter and destruction of men, women, children, homes, churches, mosques, and people in such a short period of time. That should tell us more than we want to know. When have you ever heard about Palestinians' right to self-defense, or the human right for all human beings to defend themselves, wherever they are on the planet Earth? When it comes to Palestinians, we hear a state of exception, where everything is allowed. Everything except justice, except democracy, except food, except water, except life. There are prisoners struggling in the prisons in Palestine and in the United States. There was one, Mahmoud Khalil, who, because he led demonstrations, he was seized and thrown in the darkness of a prison cell for daring to support his own people. Thankfully, that brief entombment was lifted, and he's able to speak, and that's a wonderful thing. But there are thousands and thousands of Palestinians who every day endure military courts where their presumption of guilt precedes them before they even enter a courtroom. What kind of justice is that? Is that democratic justice? I think not. Of course, there are prisoners throughout the United States who are Palestinian, and they're fighting for their freedom against a government that has outlawed support for Palestine for political reasons. We've talked about Israel's right to defend itself, have we not? How do you call an army that has inflicted that kind of carnage on men, women, and children, people running to try to feed themselves because of a humanitarian trap away from their homes, isolated, hundreds, over 1,000 killed for running for bread? When we speak about the Israeli Defense Force, I wonder who speaks about an Israeli offense force. That would be more honest. When we think about prisoners in Palestine, we have to think about all of Palestine. It is not just in the prisons of Israel where people are confined. All of Palestine is an open-air prison in Israel because of the ever-present occupation that has denied them life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, you know, those great things that Americans promise, and denied them everything, even life itself. The struggle must continue, and it will, as long as hearts beat around the world, as long as I see around Abu Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Hard Knock, turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk. Don't stop, EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man, Chris Juwan Kim, yeah. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else should just imitation. Simulation, step into the zone, the Bay Area zone. Hard Knock, radio, let's go. Big shout out Anita and Davey D. Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kinda crazy though. Oakland stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bellevue. Yeah. Come on. Check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost for the fee? Hating that they made they beats trying to eat till they're ready from the steel gray beats. They bleed. Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Saying peace to their lovers I name with a please. Hey, there's some shade on your name in the street. You go.
Real Talk Radio.
You and I rocking with the best in the West.
East Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast. Dance out.
Picasso,
what?
And Maya.
Who?
My last name is Susana. Yeah,
I'm are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM, and translator K282BH